to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and today I have a great guest. I like this topic that we're going to talk about today, so I'm going to be kind of thrilled. His name is Link Alexander. And Link, welcome aboard here, as we so are going to talk about UFOs.
Nice to be aboard, Nancy.
Now, Link, could you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are, and then I'm going to ask you some questions, and we're going to talk about your book, okay?
Okay. Well, I suppose I'm qualified to talk about UFOs because I have had a great interest in them since 1964, when I've had my first sighting. And because I've been a pilot for 45 years, I know what flies, I know how aircraft behave, and so on. And the first time I saw a UFO, I said, wow, this is not of our making. This is something that's obviously intelligently controlled, and it performs like nothing can perform in our physical universe. So since that time, that first sighting, which was 1964, I've read everything I can read about UFOs. But more importantly, I've studied psychic phenomena, the paranormal, or shall we call them the esoteric sciences, for many, many years. I'm quite familiar with the astral dimension and the multidimensional universe. And with those kind of qualifications, also I'm a very avid student of astronomy, cosmology, and so on. So I know what's in our skies. And I know about the paranormal universe. So when I see something like the UFO and the fact that it performs maneuvers that are totally impossible in our physical dimension, in our physical universe, then we have to look elsewhere if we're going to have a plausible or believable explanation as to how the UFO works and who the aliens are and how they work and so on. So that was the reason for writing this book. So many people take off onto the physical. And I did the same thing as everybody else did. In trying to explain the UFO, I'm looking at dark energy, anti-gravity, and all the other supposed energy sources that are could be quite real in the future and so on. And I start looking at those things and saying, yes, but this doesn't explain that, you know, UFOs can fly through our atmosphere at 40,000 miles an hour plus. They've been recorded at these speeds on radar. And they do 90 degree changes of direction. They do instant stops, instant starts. They do things that are totally impossible physically. And when I looked at that, I said, well, okay, what are we looking at? If we look at the UFO as we see it, or another thing they do, of course, is they appear out of nowhere. They don't appear at a distance in telescopes and get slowly bigger as they come toward us. They just appear. They appear out of nowhere. They appear out of another dimension. And they fly around doing these incredible performances, and then they disappear. So now we have a couple of real dilemmas here. We see things flying around, totally impossible. They appear out of another dimension. And, of course, to science, that's, forget it, that's impossible. Science won't touch UFOs. They are unexplainable physically. For science to have anything to do with UFOs, they'd have to have a physical one in hand to examine it and to examine aliens if they could, and so on and so on. So in our search to explain UFOs, that's where we look. We look in the physical. And also, of course, you can't blame people for doing this. There's a good reason we do that. In the first few decades of watching UFOs, they weren't landing. They weren't doing anything that we could materially touch or discover that they were physical. But they started to land, and we took pot shots at them and so on. And you could hear the bullets make a metallic clang when it hit the UFO. But then it got even more interesting in the next few decades. Then we had Benny and Barney Hill, or Betty and Barney Hill, reveal that they were abducted. So now, after they came through with their stories of abduction, many, many more people came along with their stories. So now we have proof of a physical UFO. People are taken aboard an actual physical UFO, and these physical UFOs fly around doing these incredible performances. They have aliens on board, and they have human abductees on board. So now we have a real dilemma. We've got things that are behaving that are impossible, but that are actually physical. So how do we explain that? So this is where we have to go into the paranormal. There is no physical explanation. So now if we learn a little bit or know something about the astral realm, which is our next dimension, then everything that the aliens do is perfectly explainable. When they come now to visit us, they convert themselves into the astral dimension. Now, this is one thing also that we've discovered, or that abductees have plainly indicated, is that the aliens are physical. They're just like us. Their spaceships, their saucers, are physical. They're loaded with machinery, and so on and so on. So they have a technology, and they are physical. But they do something that, in fact, we can do. And that is that we can, in a perfectly awake state, we can go into the astral realm with our consciousness. And we can do all of the things that the aliens do. We can appear any shape, any size. We can travel anywhere we want instantly. Communication is by telepathy. We can do all of these things in the astral realm with our consciousness. But something more happens with many individuals. And in the book, I use the example of Uri Geller, because he's well known to people, a well-known mystic. And he was jogging down the streets of New York one day, and he suddenly vanished. And he crashed through the porch of his friend Andre Puharich, who was a physicist who was working with Uri, and that was an instant translocation of his body for 33 miles. He landed in Ossining in New York. Now, this is a physical sojourn through the astral realm, and then he reappeared 33 miles away. Now, this is not an uncommon phenomenon. It's happened to many people. There are many documented cases and so on, and I go through a number of them in the book. So what we're doing is we're doing an accidental crossover through the astral realm in the physical. And that's an important thing to realize when we think about the UFO and the aliens, that they convert themselves into the astral realm, so that in the physical, they're doing all these incredible things that we find are impossible. Just as humans who suddenly find themselves transported instantly somewhere else in the physical, it's a miracle, it's impossible, it's whatever you want to call it, but the reality is that it happens. But there are other things that are that happen in that same realm that we can talk about, and one of them is these apports, or an apport, or however we want to pronounce it. It's a French word to mean to transfer or to transport or whatever. And another well-known case of apports is Charles Bailey. And he had many of them in Australia, and he was studied by Thomas Stanford, the brother of Leland Stanford, the founder of Stanford University. And they did a lot of research with Charles Bailey, and as a matter of fact, a lot of his reports can be seen at Stanford University in their museum. We also have the case of he's a
Sai Baba,
an American. Well, there's Sai Baba, but there's also an American fellow in San Francisco, and he did multiplication of food, or the, I guess they call it food multiplying. So this is a case where with our minds we take food and multiply it. And I think the best known case of that, and this is where the reason I get into this is in the book I talk about creating physical objects with our minds. And I think the best known case of that is the case of Jesus taking 5 loaves of bread and 2 fishes and feeding 5,000 people. So this is a case of with the mind multiplying food. Now, we think that this might be an unusual phenomenon. Well, in truth, it isn't. A mystic, an Indian mystic by the name of Sai Baba, does it almost on a daily basis. So we have these instances where we can transport ourselves instantly from one place to another. And incidentally, this the Uri Geller accidental translocation is done by others quite intentionally. They can do this at will rather than accidentally. So we have a case of we can transport ourselves through the astral realm in the physical. We can multiply food. And these apports are cases of, again, physical objects, live objects, metallic objects, all kinds of things are suddenly translocated from one place on Earth to another. So we know that we can create physical objects with our minds, and we know that we can travel instantly from one place to another. And in the astral, we commute telepathically. So now we're looking at the fact that we can do a lot of the things that the aliens can do. We create these so-called miracles. They're not really miracles at all. It's simply a case of utilizing the properties of the next realm. The aliens can do it far better than we can. They're far more advanced than we are. And their mind is far, far more powerful than ours. So they can actually create whatever they want with their minds, and they can travel in the astral realm wherever they like, anywhere in the universe. And if we extend our capabilities to that of the aliens, then it's perfectly explainable. Now, we know that they're in the astral realm when they're dealing with us, because in the astral realm, you can pass through anything. You go out through the walls of your home or whatever. Material objects are no barrier to an entity that's in the astral. Now, what we find is that abductees, when they're in the presence of a UFO sitting on the ground and they're being led to the UFO to be taken aboard and so on, many abductees have reported a light with no shadows. Now, this is absolute proof that they are in the astral realm even while they're in the physical. When you astral project in total darkness, you can ask for the light with no shadows or ask for astral light, and that's what you get. The scene is perfectly lit up, and there's no shadows. Abductees also report on board the UFO that rooms are lit up and so on and so on. Everything is lit up, and they don't see any shadows, and they don't see any sources for the light. Well, the light with no shadows is simply a feature of the astral realm. Another way that we know that the aliens are in the astral when they're abducting people is the fact that they take persons out through the walls of their home, pardon me, or through the vehicle, their car, whatever, and they're levitated up to the UFO, and they pass through the walls of the UFO. There's no entranceways or stairways or anything like that. So when you're in the astral, you can travel through physical objects, and by the same token, physical objects can pass through you. So the aliens have figured out some time ago that we do take shots at them and so on, and we've tried to shoot them down. That's already been admitted. then our machine gun bullets and our rockets and so on don't have any effect on UFOs. We can't touch them that way. There's another proof in the fact that UFOs have flown through aircraft. Pilots have seen these things coming, and at times they're near misses, and they report lots of near misses and that sort of thing. But there are many instances where the UFO has flown through the aircraft. Well, that's a perfectly natural thing in the astral state. So what we have is the alien. We can control these energies to a degree, but the alien has complete control over the energy, not only of our physical universe, but of the astral realm, and they can do these incredible things. People on board UFOs have stated that they have gone from one room to another, seemingly through walls. They've stood on floors that they say, this floor isn't real, but I'm standing on it. In other words, the aliens can create a UFO that is solid to the touch, is semi-solid, and is permeable, is any way they want to make it. They have complete control over energy. And that's not such a strange thing to us, or at least it shouldn't be, because matter is energy. If we look at matter, the structure of an atom is virtually all space. So the solidness of our body is really not dependent on the amount of solid material in an atom, because it's next to nothing. It's the energy field in the atom that gives us substance. Now, if you learn to control that energy field, as people do who project into the astral, as the aliens have total control over it, then you can do these incredible things. And this was what I was trying to achieve, or I hope did achieve, in the book, is to say, let's not get out into these crazy things about space brothers and sisters, and they live on Venus where the surface temperature is 800 degrees, or they live on Mars, or they come from Mars, totally inhospitable, or they come from some star system which they can name, and they look just like us, and so on and so on and so on. The aliens don't look like us one bit, but they have control of energy. So they can do whatever they like. And these are the magical things we're discovering. And this is what I get across in the book, is that if we just simply look into the next realm, the astral realm, it explains alien behavior completely. Now, as I said earlier, our quest is to find physical UFOs, because we are physical species. Very few of us have experiences in the paranormal. We live physical lives. A lot of us believe that there's nothing outside of this physical universe. This is it. When we die, the lights are out, we're gone, etc., etc. You won't get a lot of people to realize or think that in a perfectly awake state, we can go into the astral realm and take our consciousness out and travel into all these dimensions. We can do those things. So we are physical people seeking physical answers to the UFOs. So what we've done is we've created Roswell. You know, supposedly a UFO crashed there, and a UFO was recovered along with four aliens. The interesting thing is, no one has ever produced one speck of evidence to prove it. Lots of anecdotes, lots of stories, and of course, when there's nothing of physical evidence, then it's ripe for conspiracy theories that the government has picked up everything, it's gone to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, everything is top secret, nobody's divulging a thing, everybody's kept in the dark. If only the government would let everybody know what they've got, the whole mystery would be solved. Well, the truth of the matter is, there isn't anything to be disclosed, because there just isn't anything. And along with Roswell, there's 174 other crashes, supposedly, purportedly. And it might interest people to know that in Aztec, New Mexico, there was a crash that yielded 12 bodies. Now, these have never appeared, and I think it's Eli, not in Roswell. They have, I think they're supposed to have 16 bodies in their possession, which is quite remarkable. And of course, no one's ever seen these. None have ever been produced. But this is what we do to explain UFOs. We seek a physical answer. And of course, it's perfectly reasonable why we try and do that. So, the book is saying, let's look at the next dimension. It's paranormal, therefore science doesn't accept it. Science won't have anything to do with it. But if we can rationally accept that we do indeed have these translocations of our physical bodies, and this happens in many cases, the Philadelphia experiment, supposedly an entire ship moved a couple hundred miles, translocated itself. And there's a considerable story about the Philadelphia experiment. And it remained in a different location for a few minutes and then came immediately back to where the experiment supposedly took place. So a look into the next dimension and the whole thing is totally different. We can say this is a rational explanation. This is what we can go on. This is something we can say, hey, this is a believable way to explain the UFO and the aliens. Of course, the next question that arises is, why are they here? And this is the subject of a lot of books, a lot of discussion, and so on. Why have these grays? And I think we can talk about the grays for a second, because that appears to be the only society that we have intimate contact with. Now, a lot of people seem to think there are about 10 different societies visiting us. This is questionable. We don't know about that, because with the aliens able to shapeshift as they can in the astral realm, then they can present themselves as anything they want. So it's entirely possible that some of the different alien forms that we see may indeed be the only one we have contact with, which are the grays. Now, the grays are called gray because they're gray in appearance, head to foot. They have a very large head. They have extremely large eyes, insect-like eyes. They're totally black. There's no eyelids. They don't blink. There's no iris. There's no pupil. They have pinpricks for a nose. They have a vestigial slit for a mouth, which never moves. And they have no ears. They're about 3 feet in height. They don't appear to wear any clothing. There's no sign of sexual organs. And the interesting thing that the abductees state is they have never seen them eat. They have never seen them breathe. They've never seen them drink water. The communication is completely by telepathy, which would eliminate the need for ears. Now, I want to just kind of back up a little bit
Before you back up, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, first, the name of your book is UFOs, Alien Thought Machines, and then it's How the Mind of Aliens by thought alone, create and control their spaceships.
Right.
So that's the name of your book. Now, you know, I totally believe that there are UFOs. Everybody has a different idea of their UFOs. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, swears up and down that Roswell is whatever they're saying that it is, as many are. And I agree, nothing has really been produced. You know, part of the phenomenon, I think, that everybody's looking for is that everybody really wants to see a flying object and know that it's not a hot weather balloon or some kind of thing that our government is doing, so that they can actually have their thought, their mind, kind of like laid to rest that, oh, yeah, this is true. Yes, we are being visited. Yes, this can happen. But that phenomenon of, you know, all these spaceships that are being sighted and all of the things, that, if you listen to the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, they talk about this stuff all the time. You know, and they try to show some pretty interesting facts. And it's like, okay, well, you watch them and you either believe it or you don't. But my big question is, for the information that you have in your book, which was really pretty good, because I did read it, you talk a lot about the descriptions of all the people, but yet you've not really been abducted. Is that correct?
I have not. I've had four sightings, but I have no recollection of being abducted at all.
Okay. And so the information that most people who have been abducted are giving out are pretty much the same. They may have just a few little things that might be a little different, but they're pretty much the same.
Very consistent, yes.
Okay. And it doesn't matter if they're here in the United States or if they're halfway around the world. It doesn't matter where they are very consistent with what they're describing.
Yes, very much.
Okay, and people for a long time were really being abducted, but nobody would really believe that they were because they would hypnotize, they would do all kinds of things to them, and on and on and on. And now, for some reason, people are beginning to believe it better, or they're believing that it's a possibility. And a lot of people, since they have been so much talking about 2012, which is going to be 2010, but we'll say 2012 for the people who are listening, they believe that between now and 2012, there should be a lot more sightings coming in where people actually can go, oh, yeah, there it is. It's right there. Do you think that, you know, what the media, what other people are saying, other psychics are saying, that is the possibility that there are going to be more sightings, more contact between now and 2012?
Well, I probably don't know any more about 2012 than anybody else. I've watched a number of television programs on it, and of course the Mayan calendar ends at 2012, and as a matter of fact, the exact date I think is December 21st, and if I am correct, it's 11:30 in the morning.
Right.
Now, what significance that has, I have no idea. But what I do know is this, and this is comes from the abductees, is that the aliens have been creating alien-human hybrids now for a very long time. And on a huge scale, abductees are taken aboard UFOs and led into rooms where there are hundreds of tables where women have the embryo implanted into their uterus. It's there for 3 to 6 weeks, and they're re-abducted, and it's removed. And then the little fetus is put into a tank with, I think they said, a blue-type liquid in it. And there it lives to until it's ready to leave, until it's fully developed. Now, abductees have stated that they've been in UFOs where there are hundreds and hundreds of these tanks with these little babies in them on the walls of UFOs. And from the number of abductions and the intensity of this hybrid creation, it's going on a huge scale. Now, the big question is, what are they doing with these little people? What's the plan? And when abductees ask this of the aliens give very palliative answers. They say, this is not for you to know, or we won't hurt you. You're participating in a great project. You're contributing to a wonderful thing for the future. You should be proud of what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they never tell people where these hybrids are going to live. Now, that immediately suggests a connection to 2012. Are they going to wait for us to destroy ourselves? As if we keep going the way we are, we will. Or are they going to take action and say, hey, we now have these creatures that can live on Earth, and maybe they may decide to get rid of us. So there's a lot of speculation as to why are they creating these hybrids, and where are they going to live? And whether that has any connection to 2012 or not, I mean, I certainly don't know. And abductees don't get any positive answers about that.
Is there a possibility, and this can be as far-fetched or right on, I don't really know, but as you talk about the fetuses that they're basically growing in their test tube, are possibly these the hybrids of some of the children that are already being put on Earth that, you know, are having such a tough time because they are so highly intelligent that they can't seem to fit and do the focus point of what, quote, they are supposed to do as children?
Well, no. The abductees say that the hybrids look very much like the aliens. And even the children that are the hybrid children that are often given to the surrogate mothers, and they say, hey, this is your child. We'd like you to hold on to it so that the hybrid has the feeling of the love of the mother or the contact, whatever it needs. They look very much like the aliens. Their eyes might be a little smaller, but they're perfectly black. They have huge heads, and they're very alien in appearance, so they don't look like us at all. In fact, a lot of the abductees say, if there's anything hybrid, it's hard to recognize. Their bodies look perhaps a little less like alien and a little more like us, but not much. The alien bodies, this huge head is perched on what people say looks like a stick for a neck. They have shoulders, they have arms, a torso, and legs that terminate in feet like ours. But they say that there's no hips, there's no posterior, there's no features, that they're perfectly straight. Their arms are straight, no change of dimension from the shoulders down to the hands, no change in the dimension of the legs, or the torso is absolutely straight, and so on and so on. And they say that the hybrids look a great deal like that. So these hybrids are nothing like us. They are, as people say, a human-alien hybrid, but they have a hard time figuring out which part is human. The only thing that looks partially human is the eyes. They're not the huge insect-like eyes of the grays, but they are all black, and they are very large, but not quite that large. So, as far as these aliens looking and acting like us, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Okay, maybe it's not necessarily the look that they want from, quote, the humans. Maybe it's the emotions that we have, that we hold, the love stuff. Because I'd heard long, long time ago that a lot of the aliens really don't know the emotional aspect of anything, and that they would be coming here mostly to learn about emotions, learn about love, to show, you know, whatever the case may be, of their offsprings or whatever, what that emotional part is, because they lack it.
Well, they certainly take that from us. And this is, again, this is a very consistent report by the abductees, is when they're lying on the table and these procedures are being performed on them, well, after the procedures are done, that's kind of the first thing, thing to do with producing the babies. The next procedure that the aliens do on the humans is what one author has called mind scan. The alien comes down to within a few inches of the human and looks them right in the eyes. The abductee cannot resist closing their eyes. They keep their eyes open. And the alien looks inside, and a lot of people say that they virtually steal their soul. They don't actually steal the soul, but people feel that that's the way it is. They take our memories, and they can elicit any emotion they want in us. And whether that be love or fear or hate or excitement or any number of things, they elicit those emotions in us, and they capture them into their own brain. And what people also say is that the alien that captures all of these emotions can also pass it on to the others. So what we have is the alien is exactly what you've just said. They are capturing the human experience. They can cause people to recall any memory. And these memories may be of a funeral, may be of something terrifying, may be of an intense pleasure, and so on. And the aliens cause us to have these images. They watch our reaction, and they capture it. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're capturing the human experience. But that gives us something interesting to think about. They have the ability to travel to any developed society, and if they end up capturing the emotions and the adventure of other societies as well as ours, then they could live pretty fantastic lives within their own mental records. Actually, in the astral, it's called the Akashic record. They can live any experience as if it's real, over and over and over again, from any number of societies. So the adventure of their lives would make ours pretty pale. But what you had talked about, capturing the human experience, very much so. They absolutely do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in your book, I'm going to say it again, it's called UFOs, Alien Thought Machines, How the Mind of Aliens, by Thought Alone, Create and Control Their Spaceships. You talk about the Frank Drake equation. Can you kind of explain what that is?
The Drake equation?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. Frank Drake is a very well-known astronomer, and he decided to write an equation that would talk about the odds of a radio-communicating society in our galaxy. Now, what he's talking about is a society that's using radio. So he's using our technical society as an example. And his equation is N equals, and the N is for the number of intelligent civilizations resulting from this equation. Okay, equals R, which is the rate of formation of stars with lifetimes long enough for life to develop. Now, Earth has been around for 4.6 billion. Now, when we talk about stars with lifetimes long enough, okay, let's look at our type of star, the Sun. It's called a G-type star, and it lives approximately 10 to 12 billion years, so plenty of time for life to develop. Like you say, our Earth is 4.6 billion years old, came along very shortly or during the same time as the Sun was formed. Now, in our galaxy of about 400 billion stars, 8% of them are like our Sun. So that makes 32 billion stars just in our galaxy with suitable lifetimes for life to develop. Okay, then we also have K-type stars, which are slightly smaller than our Sun. Now, that's a huge advantage, being a little smaller, because they burn their hydrogen fuel much more slowly. And about 12% of the 400 billion stars in our galaxy are the K-type stars. Now, their lifetime is easily double what the lifetime is of our Sun. So they can be around 20 to 25 billion years. And a lot of these that have formed early in the life of our universe, which is 13.7 billion years, a lot of stars that formed early, K-type stars, are very much in existence today and have had an extremely long time for civilizations to develop. So now, in our own galaxy, we have at least 80 billion. Now, that's not million, that's billion stars with lifetimes long enough to have planets for life to develop. Now, and another part of his equation is FP, which is the next factor in it. It's the percentage of stars with planets. And now that is a number that's tossed around that nobody has any great consistency with, but nevertheless, it's part of the equation. Okay, and then NE, the next factor in the equation, is the number of planets in a solar system that are in a habitable orbit around their star. So So a habitable orbit is the orbit that we're in. It's where where water can remain in the liquid state. So life would be possible as we know it. FL in the equation is the fraction of planets where life has developed. FI is the fraction of planets where intelligent life has emerged. FC is the percentage of intelligent civilizations that use radio as a means of communication that would be detectable. Now, this is interesting because this idea of listening for radio signals is what SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that's what SETI is all about. Now, I talk about SETI in the book because we are listening for what in essence is radio spillage, the same as we do, in our commercial broadcasts, in our television broadcasts, and that sort of thing. Our radio signals are omnidirectional. They head off into space in all directions. So we presume that if some planet is close enough, we could catch some of this domestic radio spillage. Well, the odds against that are almost incomprehensible. What we're looking for is a radio window that might be, in our case, we'll get out of radio as technology develops way beyond it. We'll be using other communication techniques. So our radio window to space might last 300, 400, 500 years. But what are the chances of getting a society close enough that we could detect signals that are almost, well, probably indetectable, because the power that it takes to be heard 100 light years away is incomprehensible. It's the entire generating capacity of the USA. If you wanted to generate a signal that could be heard 100 light years away by our type of detection equipment. So what society is going to be broadcasting into space with that kind of power? So we're listening for these tiny, tiny weak signals, hopefully coming from a planet that's close enough in the 13.7 billion year lifetime of our universe and just happening to catch the radio window. The chances of that are virtually zero. And which brings up a topic with the final factor in the equation is L. How long do these communicating civilizations last? Well, we have an interesting little item that comes from, for instance, Paul Horowitz, who's a physicist at Harvard University, and his speculation is that the number of civilizations present at any one time is equal to their rate of formation multiplied by their mean lifetime. If civilizations form at a constant rate and live an average of 1,000 years, then a total of about 12 billion technological civilizations have come and gone over the life of our galaxy for 1,000 to be around today. So he says that there should be about one radio-transmitting civilization within 1,000 light-years of us, among approximately a million sun-type stars. So now, if it takes that kind of power to be heard within 100 light-years, and he says there should be one within 1,000 light-years, among approximately a million sun-type stars, the odds of us tuning in to somebody's radio transmission, catching their radio window, the odds of that are frankly, I think they're zero. But, of course, SETI thinks otherwise. They're listening. So this is the equation, and it's completely open-ended. About the only figure on it that isn't open-ended is about 80 billion stars that have the possibility of planets in a habitable zone, and we don't know the fraction where life will develop. We don't know the fraction where it will turn to intelligent life, and we don't know how long they'll last. And in terms of how long they will last, there's a lot of interesting speculation about that as well. For instance, Robert Zubrin, president of the Mars Society, he thinks that about 10% of the stars in our galaxy could have planets. And he figures that 10% of these planets could have conditions suitable for life, and that about half of them are as old as the Earth. So he figures that technological civilizations could last about 50,000 years. Now, that contrasts from what Paul Horowitz figures, that at best they might last 1,000 years. So we have a wide divergence of how many planets might be suitable for life, and we have a wide divergence of opinion as to how long each civilization might last. Now, for instance, Frank Drake himself, the guy who wrote the equation, he figures that there should be about 10,000 civilizations at any present time. And Carl Sagan, a well-known physicist who's done a lot of TV programs on astronomy and so on, he thought that at the present time there could be 1 million technological civilizations out there. So we have a big diversion in opinion about what's out there. But the interesting thing is, if we really take a close look at the alien, they operate in a different dimension. They operate in the astral realm, which to us, to our scientific community, doesn't even exist. We don't accept the paranormal. We don't accept the UFO as it appears. We don't accept that their performance is possible. We don't accept that they're physical and real, because these are anecdotal stories from people who have been abducted. But of course there's interesting aspects there too. These people come back with scars on their bodies that weren't there prior to the abduction. But nevertheless, their stories are still anecdotal. They're not recorded. They don't have any photographic evidence, and so on and so on. So we are visited by a society that is not technical as we understand it. And I suppose we could define what a technical society is by looking at our own technology and say a technical society is a society that makes use of the physical laws as we understand them in our known universe. We don't make use of any other dimension. And this is what the aliens, they function in another dimension. And this is where I get into speculation in the book. There are, in the course of the life of our galaxy, as Paul Horowitz says, probably 12 billion technical civilizations that have come and gone in our galaxy alone. That could be much larger. It could be smaller. But nevertheless, we're not being visited by a technical society. We don't see a spaceship traveling across the vastness between stars in a physical form, arriving here as a physical craft and landing and saying, take me to your leader, and so on and so on. We aren't seeing what we expect. What's happening is that these UFOs are appearing from another dimension. Okay, which really brings up something that I find highly interesting. How come among 12 billion possibilities, or perhaps more, just in our own galaxy, and from among hundreds of trillions of possibilities from surrounding galaxies, how come only one is visiting? So I speculate that the jump from a technical society to a spiritual society is virtually impossible, or almost impossible, because of the fact that really, from our experience and from the contact that we have, only the grays are the ones that we have any contact with. And of course they have this immense mental power to create things mentally, as I indicated in the title of the book. They have the power to transform themselves into an astral state while they're in the physical state, to operate in two dimensions at once. And this is the very type of thing that we see, which we find so incomprehensible. One society among a possibility of billions, if not trillions. There is something about evolution, about we can speculate all we like what it takes for a primitive society to become a more advanced one. We can speculate all we like what it took for single-celled animals to become multicellular and start charging up the evolutionary ladder on Earth. There's a lot of speculations, but the most interesting speculation for me is why, among all these possibilities, only one non-technical spiritual society is visiting us. And that's what I find really fascinating. What is the huge barrier from a technical society becoming a spiritual one? And here we are. We've got them. And we find the whole thing very hard to believe, incomprehensible for a lot of people.
For a whole bunch of people. The other thing, you know, there's like the Bermuda Triangle, for example, and there's other locations on Earth that have those strange phenomena going on there. And the Bermuda Triangle is widely talked about, and yet they really have not been able, that I know of, to really prove anything that they're believing could be there or not there. I mean, you hear about it, you hear how people disappear, you hear this and you hear that. You talk about it a little bit in your book, and I'm going to name the book again. It's called UFOs, Alien Thought Machines, How the Mind of Aliens by Thought Alone Create and Control Their Spaceships. So you addressed the Bermuda Triangle in your book. So can you talk about that just a little bit before we run out of time?
Okay. You're right about the strange phenomenon that go on there, including people cruising in their boat and seeing an absolutely rectangular ditch in the water right in front of them. Really, really strange things that go on there. And there seem to be bridges, in fact, a number of places on Earth where some very strange universal forces or forces from other dimensions mix with ours on Earth. And the Bermuda Triangle is one of them. There are others as well. It's just the same as we do accidental crossovers into the astral dimension where people like Uri Geller suddenly in the physical are transported. And as a matter of fact, this type of thing is talked about, and there are books on it if you want to learn how to do it. There's a book on teleportation by Gwen Totterdale and Jessica Severin. They're both PhDs, and they tell you how to translocate yourself physically anywhere on Earth in an instant. So these are not strange phenomena, and our incursions by accident into another dimension happen all the time, and I think other dimensions come and make themselves shown in places on Earth like the Bermuda Triangle. In fact, I think I quote a pilot who suddenly found himself translocated 100 miles from where he should have been. There are many instances of very strange things happening in the Bermuda Triangle, which can be verified, and I don't find that unusual at all, considering that we can go there and the other dimensions can come here.
Mm-hmm. Is it also possible, and you address this in your book, but I'd like you to just, because we only have like a couple minutes left, for not only UFOs to be above the ground, but also underwater?
They've been seen to enter the water at high speed, and people have seen them emerge from the water. They wouldn't have any difficulty with that in an astral form. In fact, they could fly through the Earth. They've flown through airplanes. There's no difficulty with a UFO doing that whatsoever, considering the state that they're in, the astral state. As a matter of fact, this is an odd one. I spoke to four fishermen that were fishing on Okanagan Lake, which is in Canada, and they suddenly saw a UFO emerge out of the water just in front of them and slowly climb to a height of, they said it was about 300 to 400 feet, and the water was following the UFO up. There was a column of water underneath the UFO, and when it got to about that height, 300 or 400 feet, it suddenly detached the water, and this great cascade of water came down just in front of them. So there are many stories of that. And the Sax Harbor incident in Halifax in Canada was another example of people seeing one fly into the water at high speed. And, of course, a huge search was initiated for it, and it was never found. The only thing that was found on top of the water was an orange foam, which was collected, the same as another evidence that's collected called angel hair when UFOs have been around. And people collect this stuff. You can put it in a container, put it in a jar, seal the lid, and so on and so on. And all that happens to that evidence is it evaporates. It just disappears. So UFOs going into the water, traveling underwater, that's not uncommon. They've been observed at very high speeds in the Bermuda Triangle, as a matter of fact. Very large objects traveling at 200-300 miles an hour underwater, which, of course, to our thinking, is not possible.
Mm-hmm. Right now, a lot of the talk about 2012 is that we are actually going into the age of Aquarius. And according to what the metaphysical people believe is that the age of Aquarius is actually going to give a lot of people here on Earth who are going to get through all of the changes that are going on the way that the mental telepathy starts to be communicated between each of, you know, of us as humans. And so, you know, the thought of mental telepathy, the thought of controlling things, is probably not so far away as it used to be many, many years ago. But people are going to be discovering a lot of things, and they're going to just have to kind of go with the flow and look at it and not be afraid of it, not disbelieve it, but just allow it and see where it really does take us as a society, because we are in a process of changing, and it is about time that we make a change. You know, so the book is called UFOs, Alien Thought Machines, How the Mind of Aliens by Thought Alone Create and Control Their Spaceships. And, Link, it has been great having you on the show. You know, people get the book. I read it. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty self-explanatory. So it's actually quite nice. But Link, I have enjoyed listening to you talk about, you know, all the knowledge that you have. It's been very informative.
Nancy, it's been my pleasure.
And so we'll probably have to have you on, get on a later date and see if we can get into a little bit more. I never have enough time on my hour show. We talk too much.
Wow.
It's
a fascinating topic.
It's very fascinating, and I think there is going to be more and more and more talk about it because, like I said, in the metaphysical world, people are expecting more UFOs to be very visual and really to make more contact. And I have to agree with you, with all those other ones that are out there, why is it just one sector called the grays really visiting it when there has to be others, whether we know it or not, that are here, that are seeing us and observing us some way?
Well, there could very well be, but our contact primarily seems to be with the grays.
Maybe they trust us a little bit more than everybody else does watching how we're trying to destroy ourselves.
Well, let's put it this way. They have a use for us.
That would be true. be very true. All right, Link. Our time is actually up. Again, I thank you very much for being on the show. It was quite enlightening. The name of the book is UFOs, Alien Thought Machines, How the Mind of Alien by Thought Alone Create and Control Their Spaceships. Thank you very much for taking the time, Link, to be on the show and explain your book to us. It was very enlightening.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. I hope you enjoyed it. If you missed out on part of it, go back to the archives later. They'll be up. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk later. Take care. Bye now.